Welcome, everyone. Today is Saturday, November 1st, 2008, and this is the LaRouche Show. This is Marcia Mary Baker. I'll be the moderator today for the panel that's addressing the topic. It all boils down to LaRouche versus the British, once again. Now, we're referring to the British Empire then and now, and we have on this topic today three guests, two from the LaRouche Youth Movement from the West and East Coast. First, I'd like to welcome from Seattle, Rihanna Nordquist. Hi.
Hi.
And from the East Coast, here in Virginia, at the LaRouche Political Action Committee editorial headquarters, Spencer Cross. Welcome, Spencer.
Thank you.
And with me here in the studio, welcome Tony Papert.
Hi.
From Executive Intelligence Review and LPAC also. Now, where we stand in history is we've got in the immediate calendar two points looming. Within barely 3 days, we have the United States presidential elections, and you could say it's a catastrophe. No matter who gets elected, it may at this moment look like Barack Obama does have it clinched. But either candidacy is completely inadequate, incompetent, and behind the scenes, it's been orchestrated by people like George Soros and bags of money connected to what you could call the British Empire to really subvert the election process itself. However, we are really facing a kind of tragic condition overall of the population and the policy leaders in recent decades who allowed us to get to this miserable position in the first place. So the second kind of moment is November 15, which is everyone is looking towards. That's when in Washington, D.C., we'll be convening a group of leaders from around the world, 20 nations, the head of the United Nations, and so forth and so on. But we can't just look to that and pray and long for some miracle for the same reason we just said about the United States electorate, that we're in big trouble as far as the inability of people to understand anything and to intervene and make judgments. While meantime, the world economy, I'm talking now about the physical economy, not just what you hear on television on MSNBC or something talking about dollar values. The world physical economy is crashing by the hour. There's something like 10 to 20 and higher percent shutdown in basic things, in output in recent months and weeks, like steel, key minerals and metals, and in agriculture is being whipsawed by impossible prices when you know you have to relate to the seasons. In other words, we have a crisis. Now, first let me say right off the bat, a new international webcast has been called for November 18th by Mr. LaRouche. And in the way things are happening, that's some distance away, but everyone will want to not wait for that, but know of that. It's at 1 p.m. Eastern Time in the United States. I believe it will be broadcast and centered on Washington, D.C., but it's November 18th, and that will be on accessible on the LaRouche Political Action Committee site, www.larouchepac.com. And the other thing that especially brings this panel together today to talk about is that Mr. LaRouche has intervened before the events I just mentioned with a major strategic policy paper that's now available on that website on our own here at the LaRouche Show. That's LaRouchePub.com for publications. And this paper is titled A New Dark Age is Now Near, Today's Brutish Imperialism. It was completed just a couple days ago. It's being circulated now internationally, translated in many languages. It's been circulating in Washington, D.C. And that takes us to our discussion. I'd like Tony Papert, why don't you begin with any overview either on the situation or this paper itself that we face right now? Thanks.
I think that thinking people, Americans and others also, have been realizing, already realized during the course of this fall of 2008, that this system is over. the system is over, which is true. I mean, they recognize it from things they've seen, I think, that there's nobody in government, there's no popular leaders of opinion who have any answers, that everybody has reversed themselves numerous times, that nothing that has been done has worked, that nobody, with the exception actually of Lyndon LaRouche, has proposed anything that has a prayer of working. So I think thinking people recognize that this system is over. This world financial system, which we've suffered under increasingly since the end of World War II, increasingly since Nixon began to float the currencies during 71, 73, since the stock market crash of 87, since the dot-com blowout of the turn of the century, this system has had it. Now, as Marcia was alluding to, I think, a minute ago, the immediate situation is even more dire and desperate than that, because there will be, because of the insistence of especially leaders from Europe, there will be a conference here in Washington on the 15th on solving the problems of the international financial economic system. But unfortunately, it's foredoomed to be a total failure because we have an insane president who's going to be heading the proceedings and who has done nothing but total failure, at least since he came into office almost 8 years ago. So this is foredoomed to failure. Nothing can come out of it. And what most recently French press sources, the French business newspaper Tribune de l'Expansion, has mooted, and very credibly, is that the Monday following that 15th conference is going to be Black Monday, followed by Blacker Tuesday, Blacker Wednesday. So not only is this system foredoomed, but this system may not last out the month of November that we've just entered into. Now, I mean, all these things give rise to a lot of fear, and I think many people who, you know, whose minds at one time or another understand clearly that this system is over, and then kind of change the subject within their own minds because of fear. But if we can get beyond the fear, if you can get beyond the fear, the crisis is forcing us to rethink the policies and the underlying assumptions behind those policies that have brought us down this road over increasingly, ever increasingly, since this post-World War II, or during the post-World War II period, and much more quickly today, where every proposal out of Paulson and all these co-thinkers of Wall Street and the Congress and the Senate, every proposal brings us further into the disaster, further into disintegration. So it's a fearful prospect, but you've got to push back the fear and look at the problem, because what we have to do is rethink those assumptions. And so, as Marcia said, Lynn has produced this paper, Today's Brutish Imperialism. It's up on the website, www.laRouchePact.com. Our thinking citizens and those of other countries, especially the big four, China, Russia, India, as well as the U.S., have got to study that paper. His starting point there is imperialism, because we're confronting today British imperialism, but there's a total misconception among our educated and uneducated citizens alike, probably especially the educated, what is imperialism? The conception is that imperialism, and this is formalized in the Marxist view, but people who are not Marxists have it, they just don't have it as well worked out, that imperialism is something that comes out of a nation. You have Japanese imperialism out of Japan, the U.S. imperialism. Some people think U.S. imperialism is the big bad imperialism, it's the worst imperialism. In the past, you had maybe French imperialism, British imperialism, so on and so forth. This is the starting point for Lynn's paper, where he shows that imperialism is not an expression of the nation state, just the opposite. And that where, in his example, where Lenin and the German Social Democrats of the early 20th century said that developing capitalism has now reached the stage of what they called finance capitalism, or i.e. imperialism, with all these national imperialisms which I discussed, completely the opposite is true, that imperialism is far older than so-called capitalism, which itself, the word reflects a misconception, and far older than Marxian socialism, that you already had imperialism before the beginning of the Babylonian Empire in the collapse of Sumerian civilization. You had the Babylonian imperialism, and these were not nation states. This was before the nation state. These were world imperialisms, Mediterranean world imperialisms, based on usury, based on what Marx called finance capital, but based, they were world usury empires, and that the British Empire was this from the beginning. It's an illusion that people think the British Empire involved the nation of Britain and its colonies and all these kinds of things. It was not. It was from its inception a financier imperialist power. The British Empire first came into existence as the empire of a private company, the British East India Company. And for the first century, really, of the from the mid-1700s to the or late 1700s to late 1800s, the first century of its formal existence of the British Empire, it was the empire of that private company. India was a possession of the British East India Company. India was oppressed under the armies, not of the British nation, but of a private company, the British East India Company, the army, the navy, so on. That it's this financier imperialism, which this British financier, be British in the sense that it's London-centered, but it's by no means contained in London. This British imperialism was given a new lease on life by the developments in the U.S., which came out of the long process of turning away from the Roosevelt legacy, followed by the Kennedy assassination, the Nixon presidency, with the free float of the dollar, which surrendered U.S. control over our own currency, whereupon the dollar was controlled by what was called euro dollars, which then with the 73 oil hoax became petrodollars, run out of the city of London and the Rotterdam oil spot market, which is continues to be the case today. The dollar is a nominal U.S. currency, but it's not controlled by the U.S. government. It's controlled by financier interests, which admittedly center to one degree in Wall Street, but they're far more thickly centered in the Cayman Islands, the Channel Islands, and other and the City of London, but especially offshore British and also Dutch territories. So that's Lynn's first point, and much more could be said about it. And basically, I mean, if I get listeners to study this paper carefully, I'll have accomplished really everything I think I could, because it requires careful study. And it requires careful study and it requires quick study, because we may have no more than weeks to change the situation. But he shows there, contrary to all the popular opinion, it's not a question of nation state versus nation states, good nations, bad nations, or anything of the sort. You have a triumphant right now, even though it's not going to last, because it's going to be destroyed, inevitably, one way or the other. But you have a triumphant world British financier imperialism, which is within reach of destroying the institution of the nation state altogether. The United States and other nation states, which, you know, are the only thing that stands between their citizens and total destruction. But their heads are on the chopping block. And you stand before a situation where the British can achieve the longstanding goal of people like their Prince Philip, the royal consort, of drastically reducing world population amidst starvation, the spread of old and new diseases, and human diseases, plant diseases, animal diseases, and so forth. What Lynn has said, and I know our regular listeners know this well, is that what we are in now is not a recession. It's not a depression. It's a civilizational collapse. It's what's called a systemic collapse, a cultural, economic, financial breakdown collapse, of which the only thing comparable in modern history is the 14th century collapse, where Europe in the medieval period was dominated by a precisely similar imperialism, this time headquartered in Venice. In subsequent centuries moved its headquarters north to London and Holland. But it was medieval Europe was run by a financier empire centered in Venice, but with many other locations, especially in northern Italy, satellite locations, which was an empire of usury, which bled the entirety of Europe and even adjacent regions, just the way our hedge fund and derivatives speculating financiers have bled our country and Europe and developing country even more so to the brink of death, until a final break occurred right in the middle of the 1300s with the King of England, Edward III, repudiated the debt. The entire system collapsed, and Europe's population was almost immediately decimated by the Black Death, which, I mean, LaRouche uses the figure, the Black Death reduced the population of Europe by a third and eliminated half the parishes of Europe. I mean, if you read Barbara Tuchman's book, Distant Mirror, it really looks like it was reduced in the course of decades by the recurrence of the Black Death, along with many other plagues, in effect, warfare and so forth. It was reduced by more than a third through the whole process. It was a civilizational collapse. That's what we face today.
Right. Now, another aspect of the paper has to do, the question before us today in this crisis, is why would anyone go along with this, I mean in this specific way? Some of the things you just mentioned, Tony, are known, say, to the United States citizens, even if they have a poor education. They may have heard we fought a revolution against against Britain, against the British East India Company. We know that the British burned down the U.S. Capitol in 1812. I mean, we know that the British brought over troops and supported the opposition to Abraham Lincoln. I mean, certain things are known. But yet, really, people have gone all along with this idea that of globalization. And in recent weeks, actually, if you do something bad for your health, like watch television over September to the present time, you'd seen a whole sequence of people. Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister, was here saying, the world is in crisis, therefore we need more globalization, which is a little like saying snow is black. So the question LaRouche goes into, well, he goes into many things, is the kind of problem of thinking and empiricism as a way of thinking, which really means you don't know anything. There's an ideology of empiricism he talked about. And Rihanna, let me just ask you if you want to say something about this. You formed a journal a few years ago on the LaRouche-Riemann physical economic method, and have been dealing with exactly that, right? How to think, what is real science? Would you speak about this, or any observations from LaRouche's paper about this question?
Well, yeah, I think it's given all of the different predicates of the collapse and the things that we could list as far as the devolution of our infrastructure, the actual standard of living of people in the world as a whole, but also in our country. I mean, the idea of being able to support a family on a single income, for instance, and just some very simple things. The idea about being able to access healthcare or to really access education has been diminishing for a long time. And I think sometimes, particularly in this question of how did we get here? How is it that people have allowed ourselves to get to this point? The thing that is overlooked is the very thing that LaRouche has been hitting on continually, and particularly in this paper, on the question of human creativity.
Right.
And how it is that that human beings have acted differently than animals in the beginning at all. One thing that we've done, the journal that you speak of has gone through a process of development because, initially the young people who came along around LaRouche, particularly around the 2000 and 2004 presidential campaigns, even those of us who had gone to college or had thought of ourselves having some sort of a college education found that we really didn't know very much at all. I mean, even reading through Lynn's latest paper, I had to go back and review a whole lot of Roman history, for instance. And that's from someone who thought, I got a good education. I had a classical background, you know. But that, so in facing that, we've had to sort of develop an education process on our own with LaRouche's direction, which he's expended a great deal of energy in doing. And Dunamis is just one small aspect of what we've been doing. But the process has really displayed to me over the course of 7 years that LaRouche, he really is exactly right on this question of human creativity. When you begin to look at the developments of history from the standpoint of what kind of breakthroughs were being made and how those were then transmitted to a culture, certain things become very clear about how societies have failed in the past. And I say this with respect to the Roman Empire because one of the glaring features of the Roman Empire was, one, exactly what Tony was talking about, in that it was never a Roman nation state that became an empire, but really an empire then kind of used Rome and Italy as a base of operations, and at a certain point really completely wiped away any real kind of national identity that had existed there. And you get a sense of that by the massive depopulation that occurred in central Italy that the various emperors kept trying to amend. I mean, because you just have this complete, collapsing of population. So something isn't going well. The other thing is that even when you read a British history, even one that's very, apologetic, not even apologetic, but very laudatory about the Romans in general, they can't deny that there was no scientific development for centuries. None. Almost nothing. I mean, they try to point to certain things in the waterworks, the roads, but really there was no development, not in art. You can't point to anything that was an actual original discovery. Not something that wasn't a poor copy of an earlier period of Greek history. And it's very glaring. So then you wonder, as you look at it, how was it that this society kept going? And as you read these different pieces, if you survey Tacitus, for instance, you begin to wonder, how did a society let itself continue to go in this way for so long? And again, I mean, that's where there's no consideration at all of this question of creativity, which is what we're fighting so hard to bring to the consciousness of the population and to bring to the consciousness of these leaders of state. Because, when you get down to brass tacks, a person's real self-interest lies in the actual survival of the society of which they're a part. And given the given way in which things are going and the these ideas about globalization, depopulation, environmentalism, it's clear that there's no way that this society in this form will be able to survive. So then the question becomes a very personal one in a certain way, and that's where the real nub of the matter lies, and that's what LaRouche has been working so hard to to develop.
Right.
Can I butt in?
Yes, I was just going to ask you, would you go ahead, okay. Spencer?
All right. I just figured something out from what Rihanna just went through. Possibly, I think something that LaRouche was expressing in his paper and Tony brought up, namely that empires don't develop from nation states, as in any sort of kingdom wouldn't develop an imperial system. And I thought a funny joke that might help people think about this is, why would a system that is dedicated to the destruction of nation states develop from a nation state? It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Exactly.
But
it grabs
but I
the nation state.
Thinking,
it grabs the okay. nation state. It grabs the nation state like a parasite grabs its host. And you show that in every case. The nation state is grabbed by the parasite as a host and a home, you know, the way some of these crabs grab a snail shell to live in. But it's not a product of the nation state. It's this documented. The British case, the Roman case, the Persian case, the Babylonian case also even.
Spain.
Exactly. And I also want to take a cue from what Marcia, you had asked originally, and then something that Rihanna brought up about how a nation comes to be demoralized to accept these policies or accept this state of existence and living and just a backward way of life. And I think we should bring up something that has come up recently in our publications, and we have some writings on it on LaRouchePack.com, around the threat of, I mean, Marcia brought up this thing that Obama looks like he's going to take the presidency. And despite his failures, he tends to remind me of Edgar Allan Poe's The Man That Was Used Up. It's all used up. Or even, I often delight in imagining him as a Cheshire Cat from Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, where you can ask him a question, a serious question of policy, and he'll respond with pretty much nonsense. But despite that, the one thing he did do in a certain way, even though it wasn't the best way, was to, you might say, inspire the population with an idea that things could change. And his policies are not capable of significantly changing anything, but he does have that behind him. He does have that social notion behind him coming into the White House, into the U.S. presidency. And LaRouche has pointed out over the last couple of days, and this is what we've been warning about, a serious threat of, if he takes the presidency, his immediate or near-immediate assassination. And if you think about that threat and the ability of that, I mean, sort of think about what we know, what happened to the United States after John F. Kennedy's assassination. And this, we've covered this in some of our recent LaRouche Tech videos, namely the 1989's Part 1 and 2. But that sort of demoralization, that sort of threat, has the potential, as LaRouche identified this morning, to bring in a complete world dictatorship centered around finance that would return us to something that Tuchman talked about, but nowhere near to the degree that is potential now. So I wanted to bring that up.
Because of the complete chaos that would result.
Mm-hmm.
The complete demoralization and complete chaos that would result from such an assassination. So you'll see a statement on the website in which LaRouche calls on Americans to come together, regardless of party, to prevent such an assassination. And also, if we're incapable of preventing it, to prevent the effects, which Spencer just identified.
Yeah, let me mention that exactly. Please look on the website. That will be LaRouchePack.com. And last night, what was posted is a true classical tragedy. Our economy is bushed. It says our economy is bushed. And does call on echelons of people in the country who are part of the institutional, concept of the presidency, not the individual who might be occupying the White House, to come forward and fast, as Tony said, bipartisan, and move on this, which is, of course, what our topic is today. One thing, we can go back and forth on things, but this question of intervening to to discuss with people in different parts of the United States and in capitals around the world, leadership groups on campuses that have been open for a couple months, and where we've been, where these videos and where the whole impact of the organizing and the LaRouche Political Action Committee's website is taking place. Rihanna, do you want to say something about Isaac Newton making an appearance? He's been seen in Seattle.
Well, so as part of this journal that we put out, a few other individuals and I made this film, called The Harvard Yard, and we go through the actual fraud of the figure of Isaac Newton and the idea that he discovered. Really, that he discovered anything at all. And so we've been using this to go onto the campuses. One thing that people don't get, they often, is the connection, the deep connection between this question of who you think it was that made a discovery and the nature of that discovery, the nature of a discovery itself, and the situation we find ourselves in on the verge or in the midst of an ongoing dark age right now. And so we've been using this to kind of awaken some of the minds on the campus, and people have had a lot of fun. So they had a table set up with Isaac Newton in a big robe, and people were invited to come over that Isaac could help them to make a discovery. He'd then bounce an apple on their head and tell them, "It's done. You just need to write it down." And so this actually had a really good effect. Then we showed the film actually on the wall of the library in the evening, and this created a whole a lot of activity. People were very shocked. And we've gone into classrooms as well, where what you find is that often the students are almost completely asleep, and then when they see that there's something there, they're not really sure what it is, but they begin to get excited, and we've had a lot of activity, people wondering why it is that we've chosen this particular target. And I find it very interesting from the standpoint, like I said, tie it back to what I was saying about Rome and the lack of scientific discovery there. When you find, Charles Babbage, who was a scientist in Great Britain, actually wrote a very biting tract on the fact that science in Britain was falling way behind the continent because they were so adherent to Isaac Newton.
Called deism and dotage.
Yeah,
which is a pun, a multiple pun.
Multiple puns. Yeah. Yeah, if you want to say something more, Tony, it's just quite delightful. You get a sense that the real destruction comes when people in a society stop thinking, and that process is when you look at the nation of Great Britain, which has, as we've been talking about, used as a host for this financial empire. Really for quite a long time now. I mean, going, somewhere around 400 years. You see what a deleterious effect that has on the population itself. They don't benefit from it. And you see that in the United States as well. That the more that people have adhered to a sort of a traditional method in education, the more that they just sort of repeat what they're told and are afraid to break with that, which we go through in this film, you see how what was once the cutting edge and the inspiration of the world in scientific development is languishing. It's languishing in the United States.
Right. Do you have more on that, Spencer? Or I'll tell you what comes to mind. I read some of what you wrote in 2007 and in the journal, Dunamis, and you said that there's a time, economics is the realm where science, belief systems, and human survival are all the same thing. It's certainly the case now that you can't have a separate category for the question of economic existence. Science is somewhere in a different category. and belief systems you can just keep totally separate. So do you have more thoughts on that? I think you were also raising, and I'll mention here, again, referring people to this paper of LaRouche. We'll give it out its citation many times, but you were referring, too, to the terrible green fascist lies you get in science from Al Gore and other people that have been taken up. And when it comes to the obvious consequences of this everywhere, but especially in Africa, that the denial of the means to existence. We have genocide underway in Africa. But go ahead, Spencer.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I forgot I wrote those lines. But it's definitely true. It's the point of crisis now, as I think everyone on this discussion has been bringing up and developing. And Tony mentioned earlier that thinking people recognize the crisis. I think also that non-thinking people recognize it too, even or you might say people thinking the wrong way recognize it too. And by that I mean one of the reactions to the current crisis has been from these traditional fascist networks around the globe, such as the World Wildlife Fund, a group founded by elements of the fascist Nazi Party in Germany, some different elements of Prince Bernard of the Netherlands, some of these Nazi elements. And their organization is dedicated to nothing other than the destruction of living standards for especially third world populations. So organizations like this and current Prince Charles and these organizations, one of the ways they've reacted to the crisis is by proposing more of the same, and almost as a sad echo of Tony Blair, more of the same will help us get out of the crisis. Or in other words, part of the problem might be too many humans, so we should look at reducing the world population or reducing living standards because, you know, we're too big for our britches or something. And I'd also say that one of the other ways, from the second part of Marcia's question, and also something that Duamese is a part of, the way we've at LPAC, at LaRouche PAC, have been trying to help communicate LaRouche's concepts, the necessary policies for implementation internationally now, is through the means of different media, as in the population has been dumbed down, as LaRouche, as Rihanna identified, and as LaRouche has been identifying. And so we have resorted to media that has the potential to more effectively communicate the necessary policies. And we've seen that in the films, as Rihanna's mentioned, but also other films we've done on the hyperinflationary policies of Germany, 1923, on the Democratic Convention, 1932, and the momentous decision there, and similar means.
Yeah, I would actually just interject. I mean, there's actually a number of these now that touch on different aspects of what we're speaking about. There's an entire array that is developing now out of the office in which Spencer is currently working, including some short vignettes, which are incredibly useful. There's one on LaRouche's Strategic Defense Initiative, which is really good in that it gives a sense of what I'm talking about in terms of the scientific development and the United States and what its real role is. And then there's also one on Tony Rezko, which is pretty funny, and also gets at some of these cultural questions in a very good way.
Oh, that's good. Well, let me ask. Let me just throw in here, you can toss it somewhere else, but I don't want the show to finish since we have Tony here, going back to history again, because LaRouche has chosen, again, to underscore this point that we have to understand what imperialism is, especially maybe our Russian friends, if you'd say something about that. He says, I really want the question of United States and Russia and its relations over the decades to be set straight on this, and he raises the figure of Rosa Luxemburg, who stands out around 1900, we're talking about roughly, as a person who did understand things. Could you just say something about that?
The background is that, or the background from one angle is that the LaRouche has very concrete, program for getting out of this crisis, which is the only one on the table. It's the only one that'll work. It involves a new global Bretton Woods arrangement with heavy investment in infrastructure, basic public infrastructure throughout the world, with emphasis on third world, especially Eurasia, Africa, creation of international credits based on the ability of the unique ability of the U.S. Constitution to create productive credit by government action. But to do this at this moment, given the strength of the opposition, which is the British Empire, it can only be done by a concert of the big four powers, as I mentioned once before: the U.S., Russia, China, India. It's similar, to Roosevelt's putting together the big three and the big four, slightly different constellation when he was alive. Can be only done in that way. In a sense, it's Russia where the discussion of Lin's ideas is most advanced and most public. It's all over the place in Russia, in every area. So this is a critical role of Russia in this period. But post-communist Russia is hindered in this respect by what in this period comes out as the Marxist legacy. And now what that is, I don't want to go into detail here unless it's necessary, but what it is fundamentally is what Marx picked up in Britain. Marx did all his writing, his mature adult writing, in the British Museum. It was today called the British Library, which is the headquarters of British intelligence, where he was taken under the wing of British intelligence and based his writings, based everything on Adam Smith, Ricardo, and the other, the British Haileybury School, actually the British East India Company. Now, Marx expressed this in a particular way, but what these writers are saying, which is what Rihanna is saying about Isaac Newton, an exemplar of the same thing, very directly so, what they're saying is there is no such thing as human creativity. There was a well-known British statesman, I'm not sure if he's still alive, who had a meeting with Lyndon LaRouche years ago. And the way this guy, who was an establishment figure, the way he began the meeting was by walking into the room and before introducing himself or anything, he said, "There is no divine spark in man. You're completely wrong about that. There is no divine spark in man." And that's what Isaac Newton says. That's what Adam Smith says, Ricardo, David Hume, and the rest of them, and therefore Karl Marx, who got it from them. But there is no solution to this crisis without human creativity, without deliberate fostering of human creativity in the ways in which it can be done, which are very practical, very direct. They're the things I said, but to explain all that on the program might take too long. But this can be done. It must be done. It's the only way out of the crisis. And yet, it's precisely the existence of human creativity that these empiricist figures deny. And, I realized reading the paper, I suppose everybody else has realized it, that our Declaration of Independence was written by Thomas Jefferson, but it was really dictated by Benjamin Franklin. And it begins, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." These truths, which means not the truths of British empiricism, the opposite, totally different truths. It's simple. That was our Declaration of Independence. People ignore today, naturally enough, because they fall into the same error as the imperialists against whom we were fighting. They ignore what it says.
Yeah, there can be alternate truths. It's everyone's opinion.
What it's saying is, contrary to the self-evident truths of Adam Smith and Hume and Ricardo and Newton and so forth, which is that there is no such thing as human, distinctively human nature above the animals, just the contrary. So this is what we're fighting, and this is what, in a sense, we have to defeat. We have to defeat in your mind the mind of the listener, the mind of those listeners who are going to play a leadership part, as you must, in reversing this situation.
Right. Thank you. Now, well, let me ask another thing again that was treated by LaRouche's paper, but Rihanna, I had you in mind for this area of consideration because you've mentioned infrastructure, but LaRouche goes into the whole dynamic role of infrastructure from the point of view of creative ideas, the transmission, the transformation of the whole human ecology, considered rightly, not considered by these crazy green fascist environmentalists because they've taken the name ecology. But conceptualizing an economy from that point of view, which LaRouche goes into, Rihanna, you may have more thoughts on that. And also, what about, you've recently had cadre school weekends, you're dealing with young people all the time or whoever comes to these, and how do you find people are open or closed to think about this, or what engages people in thinking about it?
Well, it's funny, these two questions I think are actually quite related in that in the treatment of infrastructure. And if you think of it in terms of a culture, which is also what I've thought about recently a lot, sparked by LaRouche, is that, for instance, you might have a very good business idea. You might have an innovation in manufacturing that is very unique and could benefit society greatly. But without a power supply, without a mode of transportation, without water, it doesn't matter. Your idea will die with you, and it will have no benefit on society. Similarly, with the question of an individual in society, LaRouche has been saying this much more emphatically lately. He said it all along, but recently very emphatically, that there is no such thing as a tragic individual. There's a tragic society. There's individuals who act in a certain sense, in the strata of the way that society is currently functioning. And you see that, Spencer and I were talking a little bit before the show in different studies of different periods of time. You certainly see it with Rome. You can see it when you look top down on our culture right now. If you're able to develop a little bit of a bird's eye view and you think of it in a longer span than your lifetime, I've been able to at certain times see how the way in which people are behaving that I'm speaking to has very little to actually do with them and what they think are their own ideas, and much more to do with the dynamic of society itself. And the schooling, the education that they got, their friends, what they think is valuable, the very lack of a conception of the divine spark of man, like Tony said, is sort of embedded in there, and it's not something individual. So what I find very interesting about the young people who are coming around today, many of them very young, and many of them, hardly 18, they become incredibly excited at this idea that they can know something and that there's a value to their life, because they see in society at large very little to support that. In family life, in the culture, on TV, anything. But then the problem comes in that they also have very little basis to support that. And so what we've seen again and again are people who become incredibly excited, and then they disappear, and they don't want to talk to us anymore. And then what's actually happening now is that some of these people are coming back after periods
Terrific.
Of time, because they need a little time to think it through for themselves. But the initial response is of an incredible enthusiasm, and so part of what we've discussed here you know, again, and dunamis and different things that we've talked about on the show today fit into that, which is creating the basis, creating some sort of a strata by which these people who are becoming awakened in a certain way have a basis to begin to actually begin to think about themselves in a very different way and their role in society as a whole.
That's right. Wonderful.
And Spencer, were you thinking about that about now or past times in history, as you said you were talking with Rihanna, or no?
Sorry, I don't have anything to say on that.
No, that's okay. I was merely asking.
Sure.
But one thing is, on this question of that's been raised different times about the, it's not the individual that's, you know, people loosely throw around, oh, that was a tragic accident or something, but the condition of society in which a terrible downgrade or destruction occurs is the main thing. And Tony, I think that I understand people were meeting with LaRouche today in the sense of he was, again, talking about popular opinion and what kind of moral failure is involved in that if you listen to it. It's voices in your head or it's the gods speaking. You can refer to Iliad and so forth. And this can be played on tremendously. He also referred to some particular event, speaking of young people, when in Columbia University there were the sit-ins and then something else that was intervened on by agents to just destroy the... Do you want to say something about that, what the point he's making about the getting beyond public opinion?
The sit-in question at Columbia is that...
This was the 1960s, obviously.
1968, yes. That you had two Columbia sit-ins, basically. And the first one was led in significant part by Lyndon LaRouche, with me working with him and others. And it was devoted to a movement in behalf of the conditions of life of the bulk of the American population, the lower 70 or 80% of the American population, including minorities and so forth. That was what it was about. It was not about particularly student issues or anything of that sort. It was in the tradition of Martin Luther King, who's, as all of you know, I think who thought that way, who was a reviver of the tradition of the American Constitution, the American Declaration of Independence. But this was followed by a second sit-in, so-called Hamilton II, which was basically in behalf of nothing but purgative violence. Sort of acting out purgative violence, rage per se, which led into a factional movement in SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, which was at the time subsidized by the Ford Foundation, which became the Weathermen Tendency. And this was the beginning of the contemporary, or it was actually a fascist movement. It was a contemporary fascist movement in the United States. It's what led through the 1968 Democratic Convention riots and subsequent terrorist events to the immediately subsequent 1970 to the Nixon administration, and what the Nixon administration did and what the Nixon tried to do, which was to become a fascist dictator of the United States. And that was a big, that period of the Nixon administration was a big parting of the waters in American history. It was a dynamic downturn into the crisis we have today, and it was triggered by this, what became in the course of time called the Weathermen Tendency. It was much bigger than that. In the in the student movement, which destroyed the Democratic Party for decades and brought and paved the way for Nixon and for what Nixon did in his attempt to become the first American fascist dictator. So that's the, I mean, that's the story in very brief of that. We had the maturing, in maturing into a sort of immature form of the baby boomer generation as the Weathermen terrorists, which occurred in 68 and was a turning point for the worse in this country's history, which we were there and we fought that at the time. I think, you know, perhaps knowing what we know now, we could have done better, but we devoted everything we had to fighting that. Ed Lyndon LaRouche did, I did, and others who were present at the time. What was the other? You asked two really questions. I don't know if you still have two questions.
No, I was talking about the, in general, the question of popular opinion in the form of the degradation of the general condition of society.
Do you want to take that or take your questions? I'll discuss it if you
yes.
want.
Yes.
I mean, what Lynn has said, and others have said, but it's contrary to the accepted dogmas in popular education today, is that the first tragedy, literary tragedy, is the Homeric Iliad. And he pointed out that all the Greek tragedies spun off from the Homeric Iliad. That, and as Rihanna, I think, said, you don't have a tragic hero. This is very obvious in the Iliad. You don't have a tragic hero, per se. You have a tragic society where this tragic society is misled into self-destruction through popular opinion. And really, the tragedy, this aspect you may not see so well in the Iliad, you do elsewhere, but the tragedy is the failure. You see this in, for instance, the trial and death of Socrates. The tragedy is the failure of society to follow leadership of genius, which is not tragic, which is leading it out of the blunders of popular opinion, which has brought us to this point now where our entire civilization is immediately in jeopardy. And the form this takes in the Iliad is the misleadership by the various gods and goddesses who appear to the characters virtually always appear to the characters under assumed guises and whisper threats, advice, suggestions. And it's this welter of whispered threats, advice, and suggestions which are heeded by the would-be leaders, really not leaders, but the supposed leaders of society in the Iliad, which it's their confusion through this whispered advice of what today we would term popular opinion, polling data, what everybody knows, the public education, Harvard University. It's the fact that the people who should be leaders who are not are listening to this stuff because the man in the street is listening to the same thing. They're all vibrating to the same thing. They're all dancing to the same music, saying there is no alternative. You have to go along with this. We must do something. We must do the bailout. There is no alternative. You have to. You have to. You have to. This is being whispered in their ears constantly. This is the tragedy. This is the tragedy. This is the tragic society. And all societies in known history have been tragic in this sense, except to the extent that they would listen to a leader of genius who would pull them out of this. Like the Socrates, who was executed by Athenian public opinion, by a jury of 600 Athenians. The exceptional non-tragic society is the United States, who listens to a Franklin Roosevelt, who goes directly against the popular wisdom, the popular whispering of the popular gods in the ears of everybody, through the kind of popular education which Rihanna talked about, among other things. So this is the tragedy is the society. The tragedy is the poisoning of society through generally accepted lies, which are everywhere, most of the time, almost all of the time throughout human history, and eventually lead to the destruction of societies which follow this long enough. And really, I mean, what we've seen with this process of destruction of our society since 1945, since 1968, since 1971, since 87, since 2000, 2001, is that up to this point, the Lyndon LaRouche who predicted these crises in detail, didn't predict in the sense of tea leaves, but he forecast if policies were not changed, these crises would happen, that he has been, to this point, kept out of the leadership position which he requires now in very short time. That, in effect, has been the tragedy.
Well, that takes us to the end of the discussion, and it certainly shows what the way ahead of what we all as individuals and what our tasks are. Thank you all very much. I want to refer people again to this paper that Tony and others have referenced, which is LaRouche's paper. It's about 38 pages. A New Dark Age Is Now Near, Today's Brutish Imperialism, on www.larouchepack.com. It's also going to be posted on larouchepub.com. The emailers, Greg and Adam, thank you. We'll take your emails up on the next show, which will be on November 7th with Harley Schlanger. And that will be after the election. But even if the election's Tuesday, things are happening by the day. So with that, we're going to be closing November 1st, 2008 LaRouche Show. And I want to thank Spencer Cross, Rihanna Nordquist, and Tony Paper. This is Marcia Mary Baker. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.